Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guest today is Ben Sandmill, who's the author of a new biography, Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans. And we'll be talking with novelist Moira Crone, whose new book is The Not Yet. Ben Sandmill is one of the nicest guys on the New Orleans music scene, and he's a bit of a jack of all trades. He's a journalist, a folklorist, a drummer, and a producer. His articles about Louisiana music have appeared in national publications, and he's written liner notes for more than 100 albums. He's also the author of Zydeco, a collaboration with photographer Rick Olivier. Ben produces the oral history venue, the Allison Minor Music Heritage Stage, at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. He's produced and played on 4 albums by the Hackberry Ramblers, and today we're talking about his fabulous new book, Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans. Ben, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
What a colorful subject! And you've done him such justice. So tell us how this book came about.
I started going to the Mother-in-Law Lounge when it opened in the mid-90s and started going there more and more often because I was just fascinated by the scene. Cato would have a weekly set on Sunday evenings, and he'd be accompanied by a singing keyboardist named Rico Watts, who was an Elvis impersonator. And they had a drum machine that accompanied them. And then the first part of every evening was trying to plug the drum machine in. It would make all these squeals of feedback and everything. It really was like the warm-up act. And just a lot of different people wandering in and out, and Ernie and Antoinette having little domestic tiffs on their respective microphones. And the music was great. Cato was getting on in age, and he didn't have the vocal range that he used to, but he still sang his heart out. If there were 4 people in there, he was singing as if he was in Carnegie Hall. And it was such a warm, hospitable place. It was like being in somebody's house. And at the same time, it had that New Orleans surrealism, and there was just so much going on there. And he had such an interesting story, a story of such dramatic ups and downs, kind of a hero's tale and a tale of redemption at the end. And just the whole thing, cumulatively, I thought to myself, there's a book in this. And I kept going back to the Mother-in-Law Lounge and hanging around, got to know Ernie and Antoinette fairly well. And one afternoon I was in there, just me and Ernie, and he turned to me and said, you know, you have to write a book about me.
Oh, that's so nice to be directly charged
yes.
with it, you know?
Yes, and he's not a guy you said no to, you know.
No, he but could lock you up.
But he could lock you up. He could lock you up, that's right. That's a whole other story.
Now, he made many, many claims to fame, didn't he?
Yes.
He was not shy about that.
He was not shy, and he, you know the old expression I told you a million times not to exaggerate. He typified that. If he was telling you about music history, he had a almost encyclopedic memory for detail.
Wow.
But if he was talking about himself, it was extremely exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed, for instance, to have sung lead on the song I Only Have Eyes for You by the Flamingos. And it's just about certain that he did not.
Mm-hmm.
But it has been repeated so often that it's part of what I call Cadovian folklore. So he would definitely embellish, but everybody knew that and everybody loved and accepted it. It was part of his charm, and he's not the first person to do that. Actually, in New Orleans music, Jelly Roll Morton was very similar. And a lot of the bluster and the braggadocio that Cato employed is part of African-American folklore, and not just African-American folklore. If you look back in American folklore in general, you have characters like Mike Fink, King of the Mississippi River, in the early 19th century. So a lot of people brag and a lot of people embellish. And some people find it entertaining and some people find it obnoxious. I found it entertaining.
I find it entertaining, too. Plus, there's that great American tradition of the tall tale.
The tall tale, exactly. Exactly. And Cato was such a nice person, too.
Yeah.
That some people who are just shameless braggarts do so with no charm. and no sense of humor. But he was such a kind-hearted, nice guy that I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm. You talk about his life having such colossal ups and downs. I mean, it is an amazing arc of a life.
Yes.
So tell us about some of those ups and downs.
Well, a high point at age 25, he had the number one record in the United States on both the rhythm and blues and pop charts. And that is a huge achievement.
Right.
Not surprisingly, it went to his head. And the money was pouring in, and he wasn't really watching it carefully and expecting it to continue. And none of his other records were hits. They were equally good. They were great records, just a string of great records before and after Mother-in-Law. Hello, My Lover, A Certain Girl, Ti-ta-ti-ta-ta, I've Cried My Last Tear, on and on. And those records are still popular today, and a lot of bands in the New Orleans area and along the Gulf Coast are expected to know them like that if you call out a request.
Classics.
But outside of New Orleans, those songs are not well known. So he never had another hit, and this was very frustrating for him. Some people have referred to him as a one-hit wonder, and I've always found that to be a demeaning term because it implies that the artist only had one good song in them. And it doesn't take into account all the politics and all the variables that determine why a record makes it or not. But the frustration of having only one hit and losing his money and finding himself, he was a riches to rags story. And he never gave up on the idea of being a musician. He was determined to be a musician. That's what he was good at, and that's what he wanted to do. So he had some very tough decades from about 1965 up to 1995. He had some more good records. He kept on recording. He kept on performing. He never gave up. Very dogged, very determined. He had a terrible personal tragedy in 1975 when one of his sons was killed by a stray bullet. By the 70s or so, he had developed a bad problem with alcohol. And of course, that compounded all his problems because he would start showing up at gigs drunk or not showing up. Mm-hmm. People were reluctant to hire him. He got a reputation for being difficult and unreliable. So things were not going so well for him. He had a second career phase when he had a hit with Mother-in-Law and when he was signed by Minute Records. And at that point, he was a great New Orleans R&B singer, but a very conventional New Orleans R&B singer. He wasn't the wild, raving eccentric that came along later. And the fact that he was a wild, raving eccentric later, I think, makes some people forget that he really was a very accomplished singer.
And a hardworking singer.
A hardworking singer and respected by his peers. And the songs that he has left behind, he's left a legacy of first-rate New Orleans rhythm and blues. And I think in all the ranting and raving and the emperor of the world stuff at the end of his career, some people just saw him as a kook. And in some ways he was a kook, but in some ways he played being a kook to his advantage. So you never quite knew whom the joke was on.
Right.
And to see somebody who got in such terrible shape as Cato did by a certain point where he was homeless, he was sleeping under the Claiborne Bridge.
I know, that's heartbreaking.
He was showing up for concerts wearing somebody else's clothes that didn't fit. He was drunk on stage. He was a mess and a person that you would pretty much write off and think you're going to read one day that they found this guy dead on the street. And for him to have this beautiful redemption and happy ending and a really gratifying end of his life is a really beautiful story. So it's besides the story of New Orleans rhythm and blues, it's a hero's odyssey and a love story and a redemption story. And it's got a lot of New Orleans specific elements and a lot of universal elements.
And he also had an afterlife.
He did have an afterlife. After Cato died in July of 2001, I think it was in August or September, Antoinette Cato called me and said, "You have to come over to the lounge." And I came over there, and standing there in a pair of boxer shorts was a department store mannequin that had been crafted to look like Cato in a pretty reasonable facsimile of his face and his body language. It was made by a sculptor named Jason Poirier. And Antoinette started dressing the statue up in Cato's performance outfits, had the Cato wig on the head, started taking it to different public events. In general, I think New Orleans accepted it as part of the city's surreal tradition. maybe an extreme example. Some people really got it. For example, Stephen Forster, who does the partying shots for the society page of the Times-Picayune. I thought this was great because when Ernie and Antoinette were alive, he would have pictures of them in the column quite a bit. And then...
And he would call him the statuesque.
Well, he would do that when they were alive. But then after Antoinette started taking the statue around to events, he was absolutely not fazed and would put photos of Antoinette and the statue and just caption him as the statuesque Ernie Cato. I thought that was great.
We're capable of great devotion to our eccentrics,
Yeah, I'm not sure that would fly in other cities.
It flew here for quite a while.
Yes, it did.
We've been talking with Ben Sandmill, who's the author of Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans. You can meet Ben Sandmill Wednesday, April 11th at 6 p.m. at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street, or Saturday, April 14th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Also, on Sunday, May 6th, Ben will be an interviewee instead of an interviewer at the Allison Minor Music Heritage Stage for a panel about Ernie Cato with Walter Wolfman Washington and Alan Toussaint. Thanks so much for being here, Ben.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Listen, people. Everybody done wrong at one time or another. The reason why I know they done wrong, but I done wrong.
Award-winning fiction writer Moira Crone is the author of the novel A Period of Confinement, as well as three story collections, including What Gets Into Us and my favorite, Dream State. And for many years, she taught creative writing at Louisiana State University. Today, we'll be talking with her about her new novel, The Not Yet, which depicts a New Orleans set in the far, far future. Hello, Moira.
Hello, Susan.
And welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
What was your first glimpse of this watery world of New Orleans in 2111?
Well, the book started with a dream that I had. It wasn't of New Orleans underwater, but it was of a couple sitting in a bar on Magazine Street. And there's a really attractive woman there and a young man. And a little voice told me that the woman was 200 years old. And then I woke up and started writing the story, and then I imagined that since it was going to be in a future where some people who were very wealthy lived to be 200 or more, it would have to be a future, and the future New Orleans was one that I thought would be like Venice underwater. Also, the location of the dream was very near the corner of Henry Clay and Magazine, where the Port Clair's convent is, which is where the foundling home is, the home where the story begins. And so, it was had a really high wall. It has the highest wall of any actual building in New Orleans that I know of.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
And that became a flood wall in the story.
Well, a lot of your fiction is kind of watery, which I like. Watery or icy.
Yeah.
So your protagonist, Martin, is a not yet. Explain to us what that means.
This is a world where the wealthy live for a very long time on this expensive life extension, and everybody else is either very, very poor, like an outlaw. A lot of the people in New Orleans are outlaws. New Orleans has actually been ejected from the Union. It's a deaccession territory because it doesn't follow the rules closely enough. But there's this great division in society between those who can go on this life extension and everybody else who basically left it on their own. They work as slaves or entertainers. And Malcolm is a person who's managed to get enough funding together to possibly enter this upper class of people who've been put on this life extension and live hundreds of years. And he's a not yet. That means he's in training to become one of these people.
And he's made his money by being one of those entertainers.
Yes, he has. Yes. From the time he's four, he's like putting on shows for people in the city of New Orleans, the islands of New Orleans, and who come from all over to experience these entertainments, which are kind of really slow, long operas that take place outdoors, which reenact life events that these people no longer experience because they've lived past every possible threshold in life. And they're still alive.
Or it's, at one point, they reenact old stories like Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, they do. Well, I like that. They did Huckleberry Finn, yeah. That was a kind of inspiration for the novel in a way, because the novel is a picaresque and it is a person traveling in a boat and going through various adventures with a companion who's a helper. So it had those things in common with Huckleberry Finn, which was certainly an inspiration for the book.
Oh, of course. I love this new geography, this new watery geography, and these new social classes and groups like the Chef Manturians. That was my favorite.
Oh, really? Yeah, the Chef Manturians. They're kind of like an African and Vietnamese amalgam.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a kind of Buddhist spirituality.
It's fascinating, just fascinating. Now, I was intrigued by the scientific advances you wrote about at such length in this novel, the great detail. What fun was that for you to make that stuff up?
I enjoyed the whole world-building thing. I don't know a whole lot about the science of longevity, but there are a lot of people out there who really do strongly believe that people can be made to live 180 years old. Or so. And there are certain, you know, genetical changes or nanotechnological changes that could monitor changes and change people. You know, people could possibly live longer. A lot of people believe this. So I did read up on it and came up with a kind of combination.
But a lot of really ancient longings remain to be loved, to be touched. And that's something they've given up in a lot of ways.
Yes, I think that it's very important to realize that death is a natural part of life. And we happen to be in a world where in the 19th century, so many people were so familiar with death because it was so much more common, especially in a world like New Orleans, which is a very high mortality rate. And it, because of certain advances in this century, it's become more distant from people. And this idea that we could just go on forever is something that's touted as if that would be a great thing. And it might be that we're going to come up against issues around the life cycle within the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we going to embrace it or are we just going to put it to the side?
But you really make people understand the disadvantages of living a long time.
The story is really about a lie. Malcolm's been told a really big lie, which I think a lot of young people are told. In that way, the story is really kind of autobiographical. It's probably about everybody, you know, but you're told a lie and then finally you realize that in order to live your life, you have to throw that lie away, mm-hmm. you know, or you have to at least consider it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Now, because this is set in the future, you had all this opportunity to invent language to go with all these things. What fun was that?
Well, I enjoyed that. I really liked that. And it was a kind of flat-footed, kind of straightforward kind of way. Like, I decided that this is how people would adapt language. They wouldn't go to Latin roots or, you know, it was all done with the same kind of, like, people who are changed are called the altered. People who have received these treatments are called the treated. There's a kind of straightforward way in which people, the people who are old are called yeards.
When you die, you do this so long.
Yeah, well, they have an illusion about that, or they can't speak of that directly because mm-hmm. it's a culture where you couldn't say that.
Oh, the
That's
thing
so
that
filthy.
Must not be named.
Yeah, yes. It's a thing that must not be named because everybody is avoiding it.
Yes.
So, yeah, so there's euphemism in some odd places, and then there's very straightforward language in other places.
This seems so different from so much of your other work. How did it feel to write it? Did it feel different than when you were doing it?
Everything else I've written has basically been in the realm of realism, except some very early magical realist stories, you know, sort of experimental fiction. But the only thing I did was at the beginning I wrote and published parts of it in this New Orleans Review, and I got letters back. And people were very interested in this. And there was a kind of, you know, please send more kind of letters I got. And so did the editor. And he asked me to actually, you know, put it in a serial form. And I did do this for a while, which was kind of unusual. And then I just froze up because I thought, well, I can't write fantasy. I'm not a fantasy writer. I'm not a writer of science fiction. I'm not a writer of speculative fiction. You know what I mean? I kind of seized up for a while. But I kept going back to it. And before the storm, I got a grant to write it, to finish it. And actually, during the storm, I was working on it. You know, after Katrina and we came home, I worked on it that year. I was off that year to work on this book. So I was very encouraged, and in a way, I felt like, well, there's a lot of energy behind this and around this, and I'll just keep going, you know? So it felt good. I think people liked the myth of it, and they hooked on to certain parts of the myth of it, and they said, well, this is what this is like. Like, I remember once an editor said, you know, I don't have any health insurance right now, and I really can't afford it. And it's just like your characters in your story, who can't afford to get any kind of treatments because they're not super wealthy and so forth.
So to know you won't live forever.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Moira Crone, whose new book is The Not Yet. You can meet Moira April 12th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Susan.
I'll be seeing New Orleans through your eyes for quite a while to come. Here's what's on tap at the Literary Life this week. One big event for the community is the opening of the Eastern New Orleans Regional Library, Thursday, April 12th, with a ribbon cutting at 2 p.m. and festivities all day and Saturday, April 14th as well. Don't miss this new library at 5641 Reed Boulevard. Freddie Evans presents a story time from The Battle of New Orleans, The Drummer's Story, and signs her books, Thursday at 4:30, and Cornell Landry, author of Happy Mardi Gras, appears Saturday at 11 a.m. Today's guest, Ben Sandmel, discusses and signs Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans, Wednesday, April 11th at 6 p.m. at a book release party at the Historic New Orleans Collection. That's at 533 Royal Street. And Sandmel appears again Saturday, April 14th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Lawrence Powell discusses and signs The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans, Thursday, April 12th at 5:30 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Vincent Kerr discusses and signs Louisiana Aviation, An Extraordinary History in Photographs, Thursday, April 12th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Susan Halton discusses and signs One Writer's Garden, Eudora Welty's Home Place, Thursday, April 12th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Frank Perez and Jeffrey Palmquist discuss and sign In Exile, the history and lore surrounding New Orleans gay culture and its oldest gay bar, Thursday, April 12th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Poets Bruce Andrews and Alex Rawls read Thursday, April 12th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Jim Fraser and West Freeman discuss and sign the Garden District of New Orleans, Saturday, April 14th at 1 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Alexander McConduit discusses and signs Snowballs for All, Saturday, April 14th at 3 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, April 15th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. And today's guest, Moira Crone, debuts her novel, The Not Yet, Tuesday, April 17th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.